Buddhist Summer School, 1976. Fellows made his lecture, given on the morning of Sunday, the 29th of August.
The manifoldness of the universe is held in one great unity through communion. This communion is by and large unconscious throughout the universe. As far as I know, it is only in man that this communion can become something of which he is aware, because he is self-conscious. He knows and experiences a withinness, at least to a degree which no other creature experiences. And he experiences states when he is very much awake to this state of communion between what he calls his own withinness and the without. The without is the rest of the universe. Immense, overpoweringly immense. And he himself is so very, very small indeed. But those states of communion live in his consciousness once he has experienced even a single one as the supreme, the most worthwhile thing in life. And he longs inwardly to restore himself to this state of communion perpetually, all through his life. This is the great passion, the positive aspect of sorrow, which moves him towards religion and towards the realization of his true destiny as man. I say this is the positive aspect because this is the something that comes to final fruition. And the driving force is the negative aspect, the pain and the sorrow of being out of communion. The great teachers who came on this earth, who lived on this earth, were those who realized this state of communion as a permanent condition during their lifetime. The Buddha openly affirmed it, that he constantly abided in that sunyata phala samadhi. This word samadhi has an extraordinary significance and meaning. We know it reasonably well in intellectual terms when we talk of it as concentration, as meditation, and so forth. We have some conceptions about it, but all our conceptions fall very short of the reality of this samadhi. Let us, for the moment, look at it this way. Sang-adhi. Adhi is the supreme, the highest, the topmost. The supreme togetherness, sang, together. The supreme togetherness, which means, therefore, that what we call our own individuality here is by no means annihilated whilst we are alive. You are there, the person. But when our illusion of separateness has been absolutely dissolved away, then the supreme togetherness, in perfect interrelationship and in perfect interaction with anything and everybody, comes to fruition. And that is the supreme togetherness, the supreme fulfillment, the state of bliss, the sublime, unoriginated nirvana, this incomparable, matchless peace, as the Buddha said. Now, we can get at something like the deep meaning of the Brahma fairing, the Brahma Charya. Charya means a walking, a going on, a proceeding towards. And a brahmacharya means a walking towards Brahma. It also means a walking in Brahma, a walking with Brahma. Because remember that in the Buddha's lifetime, Brahma was the name of the Father God, the Creator God, the Upanishadic Brahman was the Absolute. But when it came to a case of trying to understand the activity and the process of Brahman in terms which would be communicable between man and man, there arose the concept of a trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and so forth. Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the regenerator, reabsorber. I don't like the English translation, destroyer. Shiva is not a destroyer. He's a it's the reabsorbing aspect of the reality, the supreme reality. And after the reabsorption comes the fourth going. See? So it is a case of reabsorption and regeneration. And thus the universal process goes on. Now Brahma stands for the Father God. And as all the great religions have put it, this which is split into three is in reality just one, which is omnipresent. Now this is a very important point. It is omnipresent. Therefore, a walking to Brahma has not much meaning. Brahma is not there. Wheresoever you look, whatsoever you think, Brahma is here, right now. Here now is Brahma. To say walking in Brahma is a little less misleading. But supposing we regard it this way, that since the entire universe is the emanation of Brahma, you and I are Brahma embodied. But we are individually self-conscious. And being individually self-conscious, we are capable of shutting out Brahma. This is one of the meanings of the fall, one of the meanings of the fall in Genesis. Our power to say yea or nay to the supreme and creative energy which brought the universe into being. And largely, unfortunately, we say nay rather than say yea. And what is it in us that makes us say nay? The fact that we are descended from some primordial ancestor and we inherit his animal urges, the passion for pleasure above all. That is what makes us draw the curtains and shut Brahma out. Brahma has no curtains to draw at all. But we have. This is what we do. Now, the release from this state of bondage, this state of uncertainty, this up and downness, this pain, pleasure, joy, sorrow state, this impermanence of our mode of awareness of our total life. This is what all the great religions are driving at. And the Buddha in particular perhaps presented the most complete and the most perfect psychological analysis as well as the comprehension, the logical, intellectual comprehension possible to us of the way to realize the supreme state, to restore ourselves back. Which means that it is our opening up. We do the work. But remember that it is transcendence itself which reaps the fruit. There is no you, there is no I to reap the fruit. It is not you or I as the separate individual who exclusively sows the seed. Whatsoever we do ourselves, or think, or feel, or speak, is done not exclusively by oneself, but because of the interaction and effect of everyone else around, the situation, the circumstance, and the actual procedure. Karma is not a thing like an object in a shop priced at whatever it is priced. You pay the price and the object is given to you. An absolutely specific, limited transaction. There is nothing further about it. But in all our thinking and feeling, we are so interrelated that everything gets bound up. Now, our effort, so to say then, leads us not to our nirvana, no such thing as our nirvana, but the nirvana, the perfect and the wonderful, which is the state of the transcendent reality itself. Because you and I have removed the obstructions to it, now shines through you. This is the marvel, the mystery, the wonder. This is the real greatness, the unspeakable beauty of what happens with the religious life and the religious fulfillment. That the infinite, immortal, immeasurable, transcendent finds complete expression through me or through you, the finite, mortal, little thing. It's something which is a source of indescribable happiness. It is a transcendent peace, liberation, beauty. What words can I use for that which is beyond all words? It is that sort of thing. So the Brahmacharya, as the Buddha presented it, is calculated to enable a man to let this supreme consummation come into being. It's not a striving to achieve something for oneself. Let us be very clear about that. As far as treading the middle way is concerned, the middle way is one which removes the veil between the supreme truth, the transcendent reality, and the manifestation of the transcendent reality as oneself. You see, he that loseth his life, his separated life, shall gain life eternal. Again, the language is inadequate. It is not he who will gain, but the life eternal will now flow without any obstruction anywhere. It will flow in all directions, not just in a particular channel of bed made for it. So you see why, when the Buddha presents the way, he talks in the beginning of the beauty, of the necessity for renunciation. He talks of the simple things first. And it is most interesting to note that the first steps are just the first steps of a good upbringing, good manners. We rarely notice that when we study the text. The remarkable courtesy, the considerateness for everybody and everything. When the Buddha emerges out of solitary meditation in the evening and approaches the conference hall, let me call it, where the monks may be debating something, he hears them talk, so he waits outside quietly. When there is a lull in the animated chatter, he coughs, you know. He deliberately coughs and then taps on the door. Now just consider the enlightened one doing that for a common mortal like me. What considerateness, what courtesy. Oh, it's you see, everything about the Buddha is transcendentally wonderful. That's why it's so difficult to talk about it. If you read the Pramāyu Sutta, for instance, you will find a remarkably full description of all his ordinary behavior. The way he walks, the way he sits, the way he talks, in a clear, resonant voice, agreeable, pleasant to the ear, and all the rest of it. All that comes out, you see. He doesn't talk so that you can't hear a word of what he's saying and you start screaming. He doesn't do that. He doesn't bellow at you either. He must have had a lovely, rich baritone, almost merging towards the tenor. And then the early simple teaching he gives about the Brahma fairing touches upon things like what you shall eat and how you shall eat. Once a day. And he himself, he says of himself that he chews every morsel very carefully, he tastes it, he eats mindfully, noting the taste, and then comes the religious practice. He is very mindful of it all, so that no state of attachment or of aversion to the food may overcome him. That is the important point, this attachment, aversion, conflict is out. In a simple matter like eating, and he eats once a day, he eats in silence. The Buddha always gives thanks at the right time for the food. He never forgets to give thanks. Grace before and after meals. Why? Why thanks? The food he eats is part of the total reality. This mysterious, transcendent, creative power took all the trouble to make it, has produced everything in such a way that we are supported, we are nourished, everything is done to help us come to fruition. That is why this gratitude, this awareness of relationship with transcendence itself through the act of eating food, and the same with drinking. When he washes his bowl, he washes it noiselessly. He doesn't throw the water away wildly. He just quietly puts it aside, pours it out in the proper place for it, and so forth. Good manners. Perfectly good manners. Now, it's very important to remember that sort of thing. You see how the training begins, the brahmacharya begins, with the simple things of everyday life, which, if carried out aesthetically, rightly, sensibly, teach us to become free of selfness, our self-centeredness. We are all the time self-centered. Watch every single action, thought, word, and see how the self-centeredness and the self-preoccupation is represented in it all. Comes out everywhere. When you're sitting quietly by yourself and you're thinking, as you say, note how many times the word I occurs in every single minute of your silent chatter. The word I. Everything is self-related. What will I gain? What do I stand to lose? Etc., etc. When we hear the news, observe the reactions which rise up. Now, if the Buddha heard news, he would listen and take in every single thing, and because of his extraordinarily clear intellect, he would know at once, at the same time, all the implications of the few things that were said in the news. He would experience no antagonism towards the evildoer. He'd know that this is an evildoer. He would experience no special approbation or attachment towards the good doer. because all these are factors of bondage. Why do I get attached? Why do I get repelled? Because I am self-enclosed. And being self-enclosed, I am not in communion with reality, with the total truth. And therefore, I am not fully human. I am just subhuman. The Buddha talks with special emphasis in the early stages about the pleasures of the senses. Now it is perfectly true that we are all pleasure-driven creatures. We do not know what true happiness is. As and when there is true happiness, one is unconscious that one is happy. One just is happy, and that's that. The moment I become the observing subject of a happy me, I have cloven myself in two. I'm in the state of conflict, of unrelationship, of wrong relationship. So that the real happiness we don't know. What we do know is the sensation we obtain through this experience or feeling or thought or reading or study or whatever it is. And there arises the psychological counterpart of that pleasant physical sensation in terms of, I like this, I want more of it. This is how craving arises. If that craving is frustrated when I attempt to get something more, to repeat the pleasurable sensation, then I feel anger. I feel I am violent. And so there is hate. Greed and hate invariably go together. And both are the children of the state of ignorance, the state of avidya. Avidya in the Pali. What am I ignorant of? I'm not ignorant of algebra or chemistry or history or geography or Beethoven or Shakespeare or anything. It's not that kind of ignorance. This word avidya must be understood. The root is vid, meaning, as it is put in the Sanskrit English dictionary, to see, or perhaps to know. Our English word vision, for example, is derived from it, and so forth. But what do we associate with the word see? I, the subject, am seeing something else, the object. In my consciousness, there is a definite separation. That is to say, in the hidden recesses of my consciousness, there is a definite separation, which is an affirmation of, an unspoken affirmation of, I am not you, and you are not me. And in that is involved also the corollary that you and I are unrelated. If the emphasis is on difference, then the emphasis is on non-relationship. And if the emphasis is on non-relationship, it is the unawareness, the denial of communion, of the oneness. See how it happens. So now, craving arises, and the frustration of craving gives rise to violence. Love, hate, the usual love, hate, conflict and duality arises in our state of ignorance. Our ignorant state is the state of unawareness of the unity. Now we don't cure that unawareness of the unity simply by the intellectual affirmation, all life is one. Haven't we come across hundreds of good-hearted, sincere, well-meaning people who will shout from the housetops, all life is one, all mankind is one, and surely aren't some of them responsible for making one mankind, chopping one mankind up into a thousand pieces with acts of cruelty and hate and whatnot and whatnot. But they will piously affirm, yes, all life is one, and with extraordinary naivete they will use the word universe without having the slightest idea of the uni part of the universe. That's what it is. Now this is the meaning of the state of ignorance in the religious context. And remember, the religious context is the context of transcendence. And transcendence is not a something other than this. All this which you and I know is subsumed within transcendence. And transcendence is over and above and includes this completely and totally. It's a little bit like this. We have bones in our body. Do the bone cells know that they belong to this particular person, that they are in complete relationship with this person? They are good solid cells which are there, stuck hard, and they have their little life and they know nothing about the rest of the life of the body. We are like cells of that sort in the body of the universe. So we are in this state of ignorance. And it is because of that that no blame attaches to anybody. I think it is a Zen saying, isn't it? No blame, no blame. See, this is how it is, no blame. And that's quite right, absolutely right, no blame. This is how it is. And this is one of the extraordinary things about the Buddha's teaching and his Brahmacharya, that he taught the disciple to see exactly what things were. Not to wishfully see something. You know how wishfully we look at things. Take the common example which is universal to the human race. Boy meets girl. He has conceptions and wishes in his mind about the sort of girl he wants, and she has pictures and conceptions in her mind of the sort of boy she wants. They meet, and there are forces at play quite unbeknown to them which make them click. All right. And immediately each plasters upon the other all the perfections and the desire fulfillments that are bottled up in oneself. Then of course later on sugar has to be added to sweeten the beverage. Now, so we have to learn to see things exactly as they are. And here the great discipline of mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness, samasati, perfect mindfulness. Perfect awareness of the actual is. is perhaps the most important part of the training of the whole of the Brahmacharya. Now, when I say this, do not think that if you have traversed the Brahmacharya, you will come to an end, a fruition. There is no end, because every fruition opens infinite vistas onto profounder fruition. Do you think that the universe, that the reality is such a little thing, that I, a small mortal, having done this much of the job, can spend the rest of eternity on a pension? Absurd nonsense. There is no spiritual pension. You don't come to an end. The mindfulness remains a permanent thing. The Buddha himself says, when he is nearing the end of his life, I think he's talking to Ananda, and he says that he remains completely alert and mindful. Although the body was getting more and more ill towards the end of his life, and he died of an illness, like any mortal body dies. But he remains mindful, and his mind is utterly clear. And this mindfulness is expounded in detail in so many discourses. So, whatsoever sense is in operation, whether it be our sense of sight or hearing or touching, tasting, smelling, and as always taught in India, the sixth sense, the ordinary mental processes. That is to say, actually, the discursive thought process. And the discursive thought process is nothing but silent speech. If you don't want to accept that from me, you can read that conversation between Visakha and the nun, Dhammadinna, where she says quite definitely, friend Visakha, discursive thought is faculty of speech, belongs to the category of speech. This is not the profounder aspect which is real thought, which is the exertion of the mind. The mind is something we don't know. We use that word, but we don't know what mind is. So, this is the sixth sense which is one has to be mindful of. We all know how we daydream, for instance, how we plan all the time, how we think about this, as we say, and think about that, and so forth. And if you are mindful, you discover how all the time, when we are thinking or doing or seeing or hearing, there is a process going on inside ourselves as to what we can get out of it. We discover our selfishness, our self-centeredness, by this process of mindfulness to such an extent that we reach a danger point if we are really earnest, and if, in this case, not so very fortunately, rather successful with our mindfulness. Because you get so fed up with yourself that you feel like committing suicide sometimes. That is how it is. But the pathway to heaven is not one of the lovely modern motorways over which you can skate comfortably. Not like that. It's a sharp way and a very hurtful way. That is why the Buddha says, virya. You need energy, strength, courage to go on. All the time. Keep going without flagging. His last words. Not this work out your salvation with diligence nonsense. Appamadena sampadeta. Sampadeta. Keep going. Don't stop. Up. Without pamavena. Sloth. Without letting go. Without saying, well, there's another life, I'll do it. You haven't got another life. This you has only this life. This present you has meaning only in the context of the living organism. I must remember that somebody is going to speak about rebirth and karma. Now, so this complete mindfulness and no comparisons, no standards of judgment, no evaluations are involved in this, but pure observation to see this is what it is. Now you might immediately ask the question, and quite rightly, what will make you say this is evil and this is good? The moral imperative within ourselves is something which defies analysis. Notice how, in the ordinary way, right through the human race and right through our lives, when we say this is evil, there is an outflow of rejection from us. This is evil, horrid, I don't like it, I don't want it, and so forth. There is violence, hate involved in it. And when we say, this is good, there is attachment, there is approval, there is desire to possess involved in it. This is where the devil comes in. And you see, if there is pure observation, your moral imperative knows, your pure intelligence functions, and you know this is not the right thing. This is wrong. And you know it with yourself, your whole being in a state of such inward poise that you are completely compassionate. And your understanding is no longer beclouded by feelings of resentment or grasping or anything at all. That is the way you really know the real right and wrong, the real good and evil. It's very difficult. It's extremely difficult. It's easier to play the fugue of the Hammerklavier Sonata than to practice this. It's a tremendously difficult task, but keep going without flagging. Don't let dejection overcome you, because that means that there is the self-concern. I have failed. You want to succeed. You want to gain something. There is nothing whatsoever for you. Nothing at all. Out of the emptiness, you and I and the innumerable particulars of the universe were expressed. Out of this vast emptiness, each particular single thing was pressed out, expressed, and it is reabsorbed into the one only, nondescript void. The living void, the creative void. This is what happens. So when we feel dejection, and by the same token, when we feel elation, that I carried that off very well, I was perfectly mindful. No, you weren't. I was just foolishly vain and conceited. I was mindful. When the perfect mindfulness is in operation, then it is not I who am mindful, But the total transcendent reality has manifested mindfulness through an unresisting me, which is a totally different thing. You see, the extraordinary contrast between the religious context of human life and every other context, the aesthetic, the scientific, the philosophical, the sociological, the practical, so-called, and everything. All this is in terms of separate things and of putting them together and trying to make a harmony in the very, very dim twilight of our little intellects of which we are so proud. But the context of religion is the context of pure light. It doesn't need to plan or do. Everything just happens. You and I, if we are quiet and poised within, can see the thing happening. Now, meditation. Why do we practice meditation? In order to develop the mind. Whose mind? Have you got a mind? Have I got a mind? Where is it? Look. Here is a living organism. It is a whole reality. There is a wholeness about it. It is self-contained. It's a self-contained organism in relationship with the outer world. That's why it continues to live and so forth. This organism is a conscious organism. It has senses for observation, a brain to synthesize and make what we commonly call meaningful patterns of those sense impressions. You see? Now, words get involved in this right from our birth. Words and the language, our particular languages, constitute a system of symbolical sounds. When those sounds are heard by another person who knows the same language, there is communication. And we know something, we can inform somebody, etc., etc. Now bear this in mind very, very carefully. Now there comes the point when, starting with the ordinary things of everyday life, chairs and tables and mum and dad and apples and potties and goodness knows what not, you see, all the things, the concrete things of life, there comes the point as we grow older and older, when this system of symbolical sounds make a world of their own, and we slowly emerge into what we commonly call abstract thinking, as manifested most of all, to the highest extent, in mathematics, in pure mathematics. Even more so than in abstract, the most abstruse philosophy. All right. So, there is this inner world. Now that is one extreme, and in all the way down to the speech of our everyday life. This is our whole, this is the phenomenon of our mental processes and feelings. Associated, of course, with non-stop electrochemical processes which go on in the body. Always associated. If those processes are not there, this speech activity also goes out. And the whole of the mental process stops. We know that nowadays as a scientific fact. Right. So this is our mental process, and we say we've got a mind at work. But we really don't know what mind is. Now, it is this which is completely concerned with ourself all the time, which we call our mind, and we want to develop. And we are unaware of the fact that this which we call mind is not something separate from that which we call matter. Matter, mind are a one reality. But because we are so limited as yet in our development, we make this analytical separation between body and mind. And what an infernal nuisance that separation has been through the centuries. What horrible suffering it has brought to mankind. Oh, the body doesn't matter, it's the mind, this, that, and other. My dear fellow, you haven't got a mind like that which is separate from body. It's not there. If you are a Mangal, you'll be blissfully ignorant of a great many sorrows and sufferings which the ordinary person undergoes. They are not separate. We are conscious in the mode of separativeness. This is our difficulty. And when we practice meditation, we want to develop our minds. Just as the man in the world says, oh, I must go to night school or evening classes to improve my mind, to become a cultured person and all the rest of it. Self-centered again. Now the Buddha brings this out very clearly and beautifully in one of the discourses. It's the difference between the good man and the bad man, as he calls it. The bad man, by simple definition, is the person who exalts himself and disparages others. Now, the good man and the bad man both become bhikkhus, and they go through the disciplines, and they go through all the deep states of meditation, as they are called, the jhanas and the samapatis. You must read all that. There is no time to talk about it all. And at the end, it comes to this. The good man reflects thus. Lack of desire even for the attainment of the supreme state of meditation, see, has been spoken of by the Lord. Lack of desire for it. And there is a reason, a solid intellectual reason, why one mustn't wish to grasp it and keep it. For whatever they imagine it to be, it is otherwise. See, there are those who say that Buddhism has no element of transcendence or any such thing in it. Far from it. The Buddha made affirmations of transcendence which are amongst the supreme affirmations of the world. There is the reality of transcendence. Whatever you realize here and now, whatever you imagine it to be, it, the ultimate reality, is otherwise. Let me read that again. Lack of desire. That is the important thing to attain. You attain in actual fact, but you don't know whilst you are attaining that you are attaining. There are two beautiful discourses concerned with Sariputta, where it is clearly stated that he doesn't know whether he is entering a state or emerging out of a state. He is not conscious of, I am entering. All that he is aware of is that he is in a state, that this is the state. but not as a separate self-conscious I entering into great states, you know, the rat race from man to master to angel to archangel to the Lord God himself and all the rest of it. Nothing of that. One has to bear this in mind very carefully. And then, when it comes to the stage of neither perception nor non-perception, the bad man stops there. He exalts himself, he disparages others. But the good man can go further and enter the cessation of all perception and feeling. And in entering the state of all perception and feeling, one moiety of the work is done. The other moiety is to see by wisdom. Then wisdom begins to function. In the cessation, the supreme functioning of wisdom takes place. And all the cankers are stopped forever. Now these cankers, the asanas, I don't like the word cankers. It makes you think of something, you know, like a canker which eats up a tree, Dutch elm disease and that kind of thing, and destroys it. It's not that. I think that if we translate the word asava into English, it would be best translated in its original straightforward meaning. An asava is an overflow, it's an exudation. If you slash a tree, it exudes a juice. Now, the overflows of the samadhi state, the perfect samadhi state, the uttermost communion with the transcendent real, the overflows take place into sense pleasures, into I want to become this, that or the other, into speculative views, and into the state of avidya. Now, I think that's a much simpler and gives you a truer, less misleading understanding of the meaning of the cankers are stopped. They are not destroyed. There is no thing to destroy. It's how can you destroy your own consciousness? If you destroy your own consciousness, you're dead. That's finished. You see? So it is these overflows of consciousness which come to an end because side by side with the cessation, the stopping of ordinary perception and feeling, there is the end of not seeing things as they really are. The ultimate samadhi, the ultimate state of meditation. So now, the first state of meditation, the mindfulness. 24-hour job per day. The Buddha says to Aggivesana that he is mindful even in his sleep. See? It's a 24-hour job. This is the permanent state. And that is a culminating state under exceptional circumstances. That state of cessation and the overflow of the asavas is completely stopped. And it stops for the rest of your life. And then, as the Buddha says, you do live always in the transcendent itself, in that state of transcendence. So, the brahmacharya is realized through the samadhi, comes to full fruition through the samadhi. You are then, as the Buddha said of himself, arahaṁ bhikkhave. And arahaṁ, O monks, is the Buddha, the Samma Sambuddha.